Mabel Mercer closing today's show with charm. Many thanks for all of your emails today on everything from Havergal Brian choral music to the water music, the Times jumbo crossword and the merits or otherwise of Frederick Delius. To be continued next Sunday from 10. But for now, it's goodbye.
Sunday Morning with Susie Klein was produced for BBC Radio 3 by Perfectly Normal Productions and studio production today by Lyndon Jones.
It's BBC Proms Week 1 and our second visiting overseas orchestra launches one of the big themes of the 2011 season. The Orchestre Philharmonique de Radio France brings with it some musical French connections, works by Messiaen, Stravinsky and the UK premiere of a new work by Pascal Dussapin. All of this rich menu of music is spread over two concerts on two consecutive nights. Join me, Rob Cowan, for the first instalment tomorrow night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Helen Dunmore is one of our most successful and prolific writers. Since she published her first collection of poetry, The Apple Fall, in 1983, there have been 8 further poetry books, 19 books for children, 3 short story collections, and now 10 novels, with The Betrayal being the latest, set in Stalin's Russia during and after the Second World War. And in fact, actually, that's linked to what's probably your most famous book, The Siege, isn't it, Helen? Do you quite like a sort of saga, an ongoing saga, when you're writing?
No, not at all. It's very unusual for me. The Betrayal picks up the story of my novel, The Siege, 10 years further on. And it took me a great deal of thought, and it was a difficult decision to make to bring those characters alive again. I suppose to me they always had been living during that whole period in the back of my mind.
Counting the Stars is another recent novel, comparatively recent at any rate. And I was fascinated reading it to see, well, there are things in it that actually occur in a lot of your writing, because there are some of the most important aspects of human relationships, of loss, yearning and excitement. But of course, it's set in ancient Rome, and that brings to it a sort of extra frisson, I found at any rate, because it informs us also about what was happening at that time. And certain things, of course, don't change, do they? But other things do very much.
No, they don't. Being helplessly and hopelessly in love and feeling betrayed and living in a state of longing, that doesn't change. And in some ways, the life of a poet probably doesn't change very much. The thing that interests me about that period is that it's so close and yet so far, and you keep being shocked because you're feeling very familiar. The politics, the cultural life, the relationships feel very intimate. And then suddenly you come across a fact or an experience which throws you back, and you realise this is not my era. This is a completely different set of assumptions, values and ideas.
One of the things that I find when I'm, sort of, for example, making a programme, you know, for the BBC about, I don't know, Berg violin concerto, say, or Stravinsky Rite of Spring, and it must be like this for you, I imagine, with music, as with the research, is that one is doing something one loves but learning all the time. You're constantly finding new things. And do you find that with music?
I do. Music, for me, it's not a language which I'm as familiar with by any means as I am. I suppose words are my native language. But if you are a poet, you're very preoccupied with form, with stress, with the noise that words make as well, which I think does make it a little bit akin to music.
We are, of course, all the result of our own personal experiences. And I think musically, some of yours began with your father.
They did. When I was thinking about this programme, I thought about what was the first music that I heard. And of course, I can remember records and I can remember the radio, but I can very, very much remember my father singing, and particularly singing songs that sounded like nonsense to me. Like, there's a song called Twanky Dillo that he used to sing. And like many children, I completely misheard the words and thought the words were quite different from the reality. And I've chosen this particular song because in the last couple of weeks of my father's life, he was singing quite a few of these songs. This is an American song by Stephen Foster, the great American songwriter. And he wrote numerous songs that everybody knows, like Oh Susanna and Countdown Races and so forth. And this song, Ah May the Red Rose Live Alway, it's just a very popular song. These were songs that people knew and they sang around the house and they sang to their children. I feel I just have that tail end of that in my life. And I love those songs.
Ah, May the Red Rose Live Alway, sung by Thomas Hampson, with Armen Guzalimian playing the piano and Kenneth Sillitoe the obbligato violin. It's strange, isn't it, how music can conjure up a place. I mean, our next music in particular, but it's not just the place where you encountered it, but also sometimes the sort of timbre of the voice, which somehow seems to belong to that area.
Yes, the next piece is Kathleen Ferrier. And I first came across Kathleen Ferrier again when I was very young, because she was, I think, probably one of my mother's favourite singers. And like my mother, she came from Lancashire, so there was also a sense of, you know, place and identity there. And I love the richness and the openness and the emotional complexity of Kathleen Ferrier's voice. And I imagine it would have gone on for a few more years had she lived developing. And she seems to have the power, particularly in this piece, which is from Gluck's Orfeo, What is Life, to have all the yearning and the longing and the resolution. She seems to resolve emotion, not just present it, but resolve it as she sings.
What is life to me without thee? What is life?
There is a very individual quality to that voice, despite any other stories surrounding her fatal outcome, as it were. It just is a wonderful kind of plangency to it.
It is. It's a large voice, but very controlled. She was quite dissatisfied with her technique, I believe, at certain points in her singing career, and she took immense pains with her technique. But she had what I like best, which is a thoroughly established technique from which you accelerate and lift off into what appears to be a very free artistic expression.
What is Life from Orfeo ed Euridice, Act 3 by Gluck. We heard Kathleen Ferrier with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Malcolm Sargent. This influence when you were young, of your mother and your father, and indeed of hearing music, did it extend to actually performing it yourself?
Well, the next piece that I've chosen is very much about singing together, singing in unison. And like thousands and thousands of people of my generation, a key thing for me every week was the BBC programme Singing Together. And the teacher would hand out the songbooks and you would all sit there in your desks and the radio would come on. It was a live programme. I don't think we ever had recordings. And through those programmes, Singing Together, particularly in junior school, we really learnt a big repertoire of traditional songs. I do remember enjoying it enormously, loving the songs, loving learning the songs and loving that Singing Together programme.
And what have you chosen?
Well, I've chosen a song called Bound for South Australia, and this has another connection because I love Cornwall and I spend a lot of time in Cornwall, and a lot of people emigrated from Cornwall to Australia, so it's very appropriate that this is sung by the Fishermen's Friends, who are a group of singers, fishermen or people who are in the lifeboat, who sing on the Platte at Port Isaac and give terrific force, vigour and feeling to this song.
In South Australia I was born,
heave away, haul away.
South Australia, round cape warm, we're
bound for South Australia.
Haul away, up rolling king,
heave away, haul away.
Haul away, up hear me sing,
we're bound for South Australia.
As I went out one morning fair,
heave away, haul away.
But there I met Miss Nancy Blair,
we're bound for South Australia.
Of course, the other thing is these are working songs, aren't they? I mean, you'd sing these as you were turning or heaving on a rope.
Yes.
And that gives it another kind of functionality, which is also rather touching.
It does. And a great deal of poetry and song does have that physical quality to it. You sing it, or it came from rocking or marching or walking or, as you say, working on a boat. And you can hear that drumbeat still within the music. And I like that very much.
That was Port Isaac's Fisherman's Friends, and we heard Bound for South Australia. Country Joe and the Fish next.
Yes, now this comes from going to the first music festival that I went to, which was in 1970, and it was a Bath festival of, I think it was called Rock and Progressive Blues, and it was held in Shepton Mallet at the Bath and West Showground. I think it was in some ways a precursor to Glastonbury. I went there, I was 17. It was an extraordinary lineup. There was Pink Floyd, there was Led Zeppelin, there was Jefferson Airplane, there was everybody you could think of. And it was a very stunning experience for me because I'd never been to anything like that before. And Country Joe McDonald sang there, and he was very much involved in really singing against the draft, against people being drafted for the Vietnam War. And in many ways, it is quite a crude song, I think. I mean, compared to the protest singing of Bob Dylan, which I loved, it's much more, this is what I'm saying, listen, join in. It's more like unison singing, really. Although it's not musically exciting to me, it struck me very deeply, and I drew on it later for a novel that I wrote called Your Blue-Eyed Boy.
Give me an F!
Chances come at last. Gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace could only be won when the throne of all the kingdom come.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates.
Vietnam. Come on, folks, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have every boy come home in a box.
And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates.
Yes, there is a kind of almost delight in the sort of tunefulness and comedy of that, which makes it all the more sort of telling in a way, doesn't it? That quite often if you actually have a rather happy tune and you're writing about something which is really pretty awful.
Mm. It has a fairground quality to it, which is, I find, very disturbing. And when I hear it, I'm cast back to that rainy weather and that muddy field and those very, very young people. And him singing that and thinking about the cycle of these wars and these young men. And to me, it's very touching, very moving.
I feel like I'm fixing to die, the Rag, and that was preceded by the Fish Cheer from Country Joe and the Fish. Helen, I wonder, when you were writing both The Siege and The Betrayal, whether the spirit of sort of Pushkin and Tolstoy pervaded your sort of sensibility?
Very much. I think I've learnt a great deal, particularly from Tolstoy, about how to write about history, how to integrate and synthesise the private, the intimate, the inside life of a character with the great events through which they are living, and how not to use an individual as a commentator, but to make sure that everything that they live through is absolutely felt, experienced in all the senses.
And that immediacy is often reflecting this strange thing that both in love and in music, and of course in literature, the things that move us most are so painful. It's strange that we are addicted, in a way, to something that makes us sad. I mean, in music very often.
Yes.
I was thinking of that partially because Schubert is our next composer.
Yes.
And it's hard not to think of Schubert without thinking of a degree of tragedy, and yet he wrote such life-enhancing and celebratory music in many ways.
Absolutely, because for me, particularly this string quintet, and particularly the sound of the cellos within it, is very bound up with writing poetry. And I associate this piece particularly with my 20s and with working on the poems that would form my first collection eventually, and not having any reputation particularly, beginning to publish a few poems here and there, being in a state of uncertainty and doubt. And you feel things so intensely when you are that age anyway, and you are, you know, putting another shilling in the gas meter, typing another few lines, and this particular piece of music, it has what I love. It's got this kind of throbbing quality, and although it's very secure and it's very sure, it's also quite questioning. Schubert is the genius of slowness, I think. He doesn't ever feel he has to rush in and put his cards on the table. He never does that. And I find this music so haunting, so emotionally dense, it takes a lifetime to unravel it.
It has, as you say, the kind of length of human exhalation.
That's very true. It has.
Thank you.
Well, it certainly is one of the most extraordinary pieces of chamber music ever written, I think.
It is. It seems as if he has got the power to go beyond what he could possibly hear or know and to take us a few steps into that world that he's been able to enter.
And there's all sort of human fragility there in the tentative nature of those notes.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
We heard the opening of the Adagio, the second movement from the string quintet in C major, Deutsch 956 by Schubert. And the players were the Melos Quartet with Mstislav Rostropovich playing the extra cello. Helen Dunmore, I'm personally very thrilled that you have chosen next some Gregorian plain chant, which I always feel is quite a bedrock of Western music, that people don't always realise it. But quite apart from that, it is so stunningly beautiful on its own.
It is. This is the Salve Regina. And I've chosen it for a particular reason, because my husband loves Gregorian plain chant, and his father, my father-in-law, was in the Benedictine novitiate, and he came out of the novitiate, clearly, otherwise my husband and my children would not exist.
Unless he was a very naughty monk.
Yeah. And the quality of the singing, again, it has that dense sense of a whole company of voices moving together, making this wonderful pattern. And it's a beautiful anthem, really. The words are exquisite, and it has that idea of the veil of tears through which we are passing, and we're supplicating help in this journey, mourning and weeping. And yet the purity of the sound, the purity is so beautiful. So
it's essentially the hymn of the Virgin, isn't it?
It Hail, is, Holy yes, Queen. Hail Holy Queen, yes it is.
It is a single line, and in fact written on four lines, Gregorian Plain Chant. It does go suddenly into quite surprising places, the melody.
It does, it does. Well, I always feel that my technical understanding of the music is not great enough to be able to hear what somebody who is a really fine player or composer can hear. And that is a lack. I feel sorry that it is a lack. But at the same time, you can hear it, you can respond to it, you can feel it.
Well, we heard part of the Salve Regina, and it was sung by the Choir of Moines de Saint-Benoît-du-Lac, directed by Dom André Saint-Cyr. I think, Helen Dunmore, I don't know if you agree about this, that there's something wonderfully inexorable about the music of Sibelius.
Yes, Sibelius, I first came across his music really when I was in Finland as a young woman, and clearly his music is played so much there on the radio and in the concert halls, and he represents and sums up things which are little known about or understood, I think, in the rest of the world. I mean, Karelia has, in itself as an area, has a particular heartland resonance for Finns and has been much, much fought over. And his symbolic and actual importance to the Finnish people in their struggle for independence, which I wrote about in a novel called House of Orphans, it's huge. And he has that quality of evoking landscape too, and of appearing to use traditional melody, and yet in fact he is the composer. He knows how to draw together numerous threads of what you might call national musical, whatever the musical trove of a nation is, he can do that. And he is inexorable, I agree. He's intransigent, and he had to be. And the Finns are intransigent, and they've had to be.
Thank you.
That piece very much reminds me of the middle-aged Finnish men, the engineers and doctors and so on, whom I knew in the early 70s, who would talk about their experiences in the Winter War and the War of Continuation. And it was so important to them. And they would talk about that border war with Russia, which later I came to consider from the other side, from the Russian side, you know, the Finnish push towards Leningrad. And it was such an interesting piece of history that living in England, I had not really come across or understood at all the character of that war.
He does something very brilliant there, doesn't he, is that he kind of makes you wait for the proper statement of the tune.
Exactly.
So he hints at it, and mm-hmm. he keeps saying, it's going to come in a minute, but you're going to have to wait. And that's really what I meant about the inexorable quality of Sibelius. It's there in the symphonies too. He sort of teases you with little filigree work, and then suddenly it broadens into this wonderful melody.
It does. And you're waiting for the melody, but you're also enjoying the build-up.
The tease, almost.
It is, yes, yeah, it is.
The intermezzo from the Corelia Suite, Opus 11 by Sibelius, and we heard the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted there by Paavo Berglund. Now, in choosing Helen Dunmore Mozart, I imagine you had something of a problem, although you have gone for perhaps one of the darker but particularly moving pieces.
Yes, Mozart is certainly probably my favourite composer. And I was torn really between two pieces to play, and one would be something from the particular passage from The Magic Flute. But I love the Requiem, and the thing I particularly love about it is it's that forward pulsating movement that he has, that driving towards who knows where. And then the purity, particularly of the Vocal Me, which is quite frail, it's quite a fragile line within that. And it seems to me that sometimes with Mozart, very rarely, you get the feeling that he's doing a kind of celestial knitting, which could go on in all kinds of ways forever. But in the Requiem, that's absent completely. There's an absolute force of purpose driving you forward. And then you have all the dilemmas about when did he stop writing and how much did he leave to be carried forward.
Because how much did Sussmayr do?
Yes, yeah. And because it's such a text of conflict, really. It's a battleground, the Requiem too, which is interesting. It has posthumously become what it almost is within itself, because there's a lot of argument within it, isn't there? It's as if he's fighting with himself in writing it, and then afterwards people have fought about it.
So again, we were talking about whether we invest people that die young with some extra dimension because of what we know about them, and certainly with the Mozart Requiem, we know that it was his own Requiem.
We do. And we're also looking at people who had a candour about death that we probably have lost from our culture, and who are able to say, I am going to die, it's not far away, it's the context of my life, I must resolve how am I going to be at the moment of my death, what must I ask for, how must I present myself. And it's in a climate of understanding and candour of death that he writes that work.
Well, I mean, essentially Mozart was a classicist, and yet this looks forward somehow to the Romantic Age, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's a cusp piece of music, and we know that it's a cusp of death for him, and that he won't complete it and he won't live to write any more music, but he's also just moving with this pulsating rhythm onward into something else. I agree with you.
Thank you.
There's real Sturm und Drang in there, isn't there? Turbulence.
There is. There's also, I think, serenity. It's a very extraordinary piece of music that every time you listen to it, you hear a different thing. And I'm astonished by how he could have kept so many of those lines so much in balance in his mind and resolved them, often in very surprising ways. And I'm really in awe of it. It's so remarkable.
The Confutatis and Lacrimosa from the Requiem by Mozart. We heard the English Baroque soloists and the Monteverdi Choir conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. We were talking earlier, Helen Dunmore, about the fact that in researching or making programmes for the BBC, whatever it is, one often learns something new or is pointed in the direction of fresh fields. But that's true also of one's children.
My youngest child is 17, so I still have my daughter at home, and she loves music, and she's introduced me to a great deal of music. And this is Vampire Weekend, and the song, I love it in many ways. It's called Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa, and as the title suggests, it's a blend of kind of two completely different things going on. The lyrics are very, very slick and tight and neat, and then there's this kind of slightly Congolese drum rhythm going on as well. And I like the simplicity and the boldness of the lyrics, and it's about being young and the world is yours, and you know it is.
Of Benetton.
Cape Cod Kwasa Kwasa from Vampire Weekend. Helen, what are you working on at the moment? I mean, more poetry or children's book or a new novel?
I'm doing all three. I'm putting together a collection of poetry, which has taken me about 5 years, and I'm hoping that by the end of the year, by about October, that will be complete. And I'm working on a novella, which is a ghost story. It's very interesting for me to do. And at the same time, I'm just completing the final edits of a children's book. So that's quite typical, I think, of the way I work, that often one thing is just finishing, I'm beginning another, and underneath it, I'm always working on poetry.
Helen Dunmore, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Helen Dunmore was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the film director, Hugh Hudson. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and today's programme was produced by Sarah Cropper. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's just after 1 o'clock. Time now for the news with David Cornett.
The Home Secretary, Theresa May, will make a statement tomorrow about links between the Metropolitan Police and a former News of the World journalist who was arrested and bailed in connection with phone hacking. One of her junior ministers says she has concerns about the force's relationship with a PR company run by Neil Wallis. Labour has called for Scotland Yard to make a full disclosure about the issue. The Labour leader, Ed Miliband, has called for new media ownership rules to limit the concentration of power in any single proprietor's hands. Mr Miliband said Rupert Murdoch, who still owns three British newspapers and 39% of BSkyB, had an unhealthy level of power. Afghanistan has begun the process of taking control of its own security. The central province of Bamyan has become the first to be handed over to Afghan police by NATO troops. The British military deployment to Afghanistan 5 years ago has been strongly criticised by a group of MPs. The Defence Select Committee says the decision to send forces into Helmand in 2006 wasn't fully thought through and too few troops were sent. An investigation has begun into reports that a British soldier who was shot dead in Afghanistan yesterday was killed by a member of the Afghan army. He was from the 9th, 12th Royal Lancers. His family has been told. UNICEF has airlifted the first consignment of aid to drought-hit southern Somalia since the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab, which runs most of the country, eased its restrictions on foreign relief agencies. The UN agency flew a cargo of essential supplies and medicines into the town of Baidoa, northwest of Mogadishu. A volcano on the Indonesian island of Sulawesi has had its most violent eruption since it came back to life last week. Mount Lokon flung hot ash more than 2 miles into the air. Residents who've been returning to crops and livestock on its slopes fled back to government shelters. And the weather, it'll be a cool and unsettled day with outbreaks of occasionally heavy rain affecting northwestern parts of the UK and later spreading into central parts. Elsewhere, there'll be patchy cloud and scattered showers. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
And that was David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. A very good afternoon to you. We've two visits to the BBC Proms today, one at 4 o'clock for an organ recital given by Stephen Farr, music by Jean Alain, Franz Liszt, and a new piece by Judith Bingham, first performance, in fact, of a piece called The Everlasting Crown. And then at 7, we've the first Choral Sunday of the season, and we'll be hearing the grandest statement of British choral music, Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony. And at 5:15, I should mention that Sarah Walker will be presenting an introduction to that piece at Proms Plus Choral Sundays, 5:15. The prom is at 7 this evening. But now it's time for the early music show, and here's Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. In 1492, when Christopher Columbus managed to persuade the Spanish monarchs to fund a voyage across the Atlantic Ocean, no one quite knew what he was going to find. He eventually hit land, the huge continent they dubbed the New World. But of course, there was in fact nothing new about it. Ancient civilizations had been in residence for some 4,000 years, and so began the age of the conquistadors, centuries of exploration and settlement by European powers, and often, it must be said, the cruelest of cultural suppression. First with garrisons, then with clergymen, the Spanish began their colonization of Mexico and the huge Aztec Empire, with basically just one objective, money. But perhaps less well known is the spread of Christianity that accompanied this invasion, and with it, the introduction to the native population of European church music. With me to discuss this extraordinary musical exchange, and as we'll hear, it really was at times a two-way thing, I'm chatting today with Geoffrey Skidmore, director of one of the world's most successful and highly acclaimed ensembles, Ex Cathedra, whose own travels in Latin America have given him a real insight into this repertoire. Many thanks for joining me, Geoffrey.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, we're going to be hearing some really beautiful music in today's programme, some by composers who aren't all that familiar. This is by the Spanish composer Hernando Franco, who made the long voyage to the New World in the mid-1500s and eventually settled in Mexico City. I guess it must have been quite a brave thing to do in those days, to travel so far from the home comforts. What do we know about Franco?
Well, we know he must have been quite a brave person. He was, in fact, born in Extremadura, where the conquistadors came from. So he was a pretty strong stock, I would think. But he was certainly one of the pioneers, one of the first people, one of the first musicians to make that journey and establish, well, he was right at the beginning of an amazing colonial period of wonderful music.
And, of course, like all those first settlers, he was a man of the cloth, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a priest musician.
Well, let's hear Momento Mei Deus.
Christe.